Chuck Klosterman has written a couple of novels, but he's perhaps most famous for his nonfiction, in which he seems to have written about almost everything under the sun. Sports for ESPN, music for Spin, the way Britney Spears is related to scenes in The Matrix for Esquire, and he has a weekly ethics column in the New York Times Sunday magazine. His latest book, I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined, is about why we spend so much time making people into pop culture villains. It's published by Scribner. I'm very pleased that it brings Chuck Klosterman to our show today. Hello.
Oh, hey. Thanks for having me.
You've become known for the way that you blend popular culture and humor with serious conjecture. Why pop culture? How much does it reveal about us?
Well, I suppose there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, I suppose the more honest answer is I just sort of write about the things that are interesting to me personally, you know, the experiences I have, and I was always really engaged with popular culture my whole life. That seemed to be the way I tried to understand myself through. The other answer, I suppose, might be that you could make the argument that the only really important culture America creates anymore is popular culture, and that the way the country has evolved, the way the world has evolved, has sort of moved what used to be seen as sort of temporary or disposable or meaningless into sort of the main fabric of what people talk about when they're talking about art.
But do you think that almost every person who becomes famous ends up being labeled as either, well, maybe not a villain. Is villain too strong a word? Or a hero? I mean, I'm thinking of Anne Hathaway, for example, I found to be a perfectly charming person when she was a guest on the show. And then one day I read that a lot of people hate her.
Well, a lot of people do hate her, I guess, and I suppose that's one of the manifestations of becoming popular. There's going to be a larger sect of the populace who loves you, who hates you. It's not really the same as being a villain. I mean, in this book, you know, villain's in the title, but I sort of move all over the place the idea of people who are hated justifiably, unjustifiably, people who actually are villains, people who have done villainous things. I don't know if somebody said Anne Hathaway is a villain, I don't know what their argument would be for as why society should be against them. It's kind of more of a personal reflection. I don't like the way this person looks. I don't like the way this person acts, you know.
Well, do you think that self-confidence contributes to that image?
Well, certainly arrogance feeds into the idea of becoming sort of a villainous persona, but if done in a way that people find charming, if it comes across as, you know, charisma, I think that is one of the strange aspects that makes the acts from one person acceptable and unacceptable by another. It's how that confidence is absorbed sort of by the audience, yeah.
Well, are there villains who are let off the hook? The New York Times had an article last week about politicians who are involved in scandals but have been forgiven by the public. Senator David Vitter of Louisiana, Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, and now we have both Anthony Weiner, who strikes me as having very little charisma, and Elliot Spitzer leading the polls in New York. But should we consider politicians to be part of the pop culture?
Well, they are. I mean, I think it almost is. I mean, it doesn't really matter if the question is should we or shouldn't we. As we were kind of talking about earlier, I think that the way a politician is presented as a celebrity seems to have more significance on their political future and their success than anything about their platform or their construction. Now, of course, people will say, well, that's a real problem. And I guess I would agree that it's a problem. But, you know, I think that I probably do criticism a little differently than other people. I'm never trying to persuade people to believe what I believe or even to see the world as I might. I just sort of explore ideas that are interesting to me and then at the end sort of come up with what I feel is a reasonable thesis for maybe the intellectual reason for why I emotionally felt something, which is I'm just always curious about, like, why I feel the things that I do.
Well, do you tend to find to put people into those categories, hero and villain?
Well, I mean, I wrote a book about it, certainly. That, I mean, I guess I in a way,
the
know,
Beach Boys had that big an influence on you?
well, yeah, I guess, like, the Beach Boys are an interesting example. Okay, so, like, who is the villain of the Beach Boys? It seems obvious to me. Who would you say?
Mike Love.
Love. You know, okay. Now, Mike Love is clearly the villain of the Beach Boys, but and there seems to be a...
Although Dennis actually was Charles Manson's best friend for a little while.
Yes, you know, every member of the Beach Boys to some degree is problematic, but there's a collective sense that Mike Love is the villain of the Beach Boys. And I'm very interested in when something like that happens. Like, I don't write about the Beach Boys in this book, but that would have been a great example of something where I would wonder why I feel so... Like, the idea that Mike Love is the villain of the Beach Boys is calcified in my mind. It seems very almost unassailable, you know, somehow emotionally true. But, of course, the emotionally true is just a construction of ideas. So what created those ideas? What made that happen? Was it me? Was it simply the mediated culture? Was it my peer group? Was it my desire to be perceived as being against a certain kind of person? You know?
Well, another example is Yoko Ono, who some people still blame for the breakup of the Beatles, even though obviously she wasn't.
Oh, yes. She ultimately was not, although it's easy to understand why she might be villainized. Equally villainized in the Beatles is Paul McCartney. That's both more complex and maybe more understandable, you know?
Well, some of the people who have been villainized in the past wind up being let off the hook, or they become confusing. Taylor Swift, Michael Jordan, Kanye West, for example. Michael Jordan for a while because of his gambling and some of the other he had a certain arrogance, but he also may have been one of the greatest basketball players in the history of the game.
You know, sports icons really complicate this discussion because, you know, we start from the premise with sports that it's acceptable to root against and basically overtly hate your opponent for no reason other than they are the opponent, you know. It's also measurable. Michael Jordan was the best player of all time, and while he was playing, there was almost this objective proof that regardless of his, you know, his competitive disorder or the way he behaved or what his worldview was, his job was to play basketball and he succeeded at the highest level. But now that he's away from the game, he's an owner now, but not, you know, his success as an owner obviously isn't as great. We start viewing him for those characteristics that before we ignored. Now, this really, you know, isn't any kind of brilliant insight. Anybody could come up with this. But it's interesting how this works to me. And that sort of like the whole idea with this book is just kind of working through these problems that to me seem like an answer is already understood, but I don't know if the answer is necessarily justified.
So we paid less attention to Michael Jordan when he refused to campaign against Jesse Helms because he said rednecks also buy sneakers.
Well, I think he said Republicans also buy sneakers. But that was one point in his career where he did receive some criticism. There were certainly points during his playing career where he received criticism, but it was different while he was active because the thing, you know, when you look at somebody who was that focused or had that sort of almost like a myopic worldview of what mattered, that's actually a benefit to the athlete. We appreciate the athlete who seems so focused on winning that he almost puts the rules of society, you know, apart from their existence. But once that person is no longer actively competing, then they kind of become humanized again. They are not seen as an extension of their sport, but as an extension of the populace.
My guest is Chuck Klosterman, whose latest book is I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. We've been doing this to our pop cultural heroes or major figures for a long time. The early movie magazines in the time of the silence focused on the behavior of film stars. And then in the 50s, there was Confidential magazine. Later, there were all of those newspapers like The Enquirer that you can buy at the supermarket checkout counter. So we're always interested in knocking down the heroes, aren't we?
Well, part of the reason for that is because American society particularly, and it's not the only society like this, but it's definitely true of the way we kind of work through culture, is that storytelling is so essential to the way Americans understand everything. I mean, public radio is a great example of this, where storytelling is sort of the device in order to get at news and the meaning of things. So if you start with the idea that storytelling is essential to understanding the world, there's going to be heroes and villains intrinsic to that sort of to that structure. It would be, I think, if there was probably a different way, if we understood the world through something other than storytelling, maybe there would be less emphasis on villainizing certain people or elevating certain people. But the way it is, it's hard to get around.
The reason I cited those historical examples is because everybody blames everything on the internet these days. And it is true that we find out a lot quicker about whether somebody did something stupid because of the internet today than we would have in the past. Are we quicker to categorize people as heroes or villains today?
Well, I mean, the internet amplifies sort of discourse. So, of course, it's greater and faster. So it feels that way, certainly. It certainly feels that way to somebody who existed at a time pre-internet. I would guess it wasn't that different than people who existed pre-television, and then suddenly television existed. I'm guessing a lot of the conversations we have about the internet now in a different context were had right when television, you know, the advent of that period, and all of a sudden people felt like this device is changing our relationship to the world. It's changing our reality. You know, this must be bad. I mean, that's the thing with the internet. It's the assumption is somehow it must be bad because it feels different.
A lot of the popular television shows today feature characters who are more villainous than heroic. Breaking Bad, Mad Men, for example, is... are we entering a period where we want to look at the bad guys with a certain amount of sympathy?
Well, I think it has more to do with like the time it takes for various idioms to adopt that perspective, because I think now we actually sort of associate villainy with authenticity in some weird way. In the 70s, you saw this happen with film when the auteur movement was happening. The idea of the anti-hero, that period of, you know, Jack Nicholson films, you know, The Last Detail and a lot of the, you know, those films. Then in the 70s,
Five Easy Pieces,
yes, five,
earlier.
Great example. In the 70s and 80s, then you also saw this happen with rock music, and then certainly with hip-hop, the idea that there was an attractive quality to being villainous. And it finally sort of happened with television with The Sopranos. That was the first time, I think, where, that, you know, I think even David Chase, when he was creating that program, probably had apprehension. Will people respond to a hero, a protagonist who's actually an antagonist? And not only did they respond, it seemed extra true to them. And now that's, you know, if you make a high-end, sophisticated television show now, whether it's The Wire, Mad Men, whatever, it's almost essential. You need to have a central character who is problematic for it to seem real to people.
So Superman has to be given a dark side today, whereas in the past he could just be this perfect person.
Yeah, you heard this argument when the new Superman movie was being released, that I saw some social critics saying the idea of Superman really isn't relevant in a modern culture, because there was a time when, you know, the hero was an aspirational figure. So people saw, you know, Superman as the, you know, the ultimate ideal of what a human would be if they had superpowers. But I don't know if I totally agree with people who say it's no longer relevant, but I understand the argument. I can see why you'd make that point.
On the other hand, Batman is a vigilante type.
Yes, yes.
And that, so does that make him more complicated, more acceptable?
Well, the vigilante always creates this like complex scenario for this conversation. I mean, you know, if you ask a sophisticated, intelligent person, do you support vigilante justice? They will say, of course, no. We due process. We need to. You can't let people take justice in their own hands.
Unless their name is George Zimmerman.
Well, here's the deal. Because then you paint a scenario where you have a few details, but not too many. Somebody is faced, you know, like the Bernard Goetz example. You tell someone is in a violent city, a cesspool of violence. They're on a train and they're confronted by criminals and they respond with violence. People then are more willing to side with that vigilante. But then when someone like Goetz comes forward, we learn details of his life. We hear things that, you know, he shows no remorse. We find out things that he said at a community meeting. We find all these details. Then it goes away from being an agent for society and moves back to being an agent for individuality, which then villainizes the person.
Then there's another factor. Depending on your politics, someone like Julian Assange is either a hero or a villain. The same can apply to Bradley Manning, Edward Snowden, or George Zimmerman. So we continue to do this based on how we view the world or what we think is right and wrong?
in a situation like WikiLeaks, I mean, what's interesting about that is it pushes like a key question about how we think the world should operate. And you know, if you get into the specifics of Julian Assange's life and what he does, you know, it's easy to go back and forth, you know.
Have you seen the film WikiLeaks?
I have not yet.
He does not come across as the most positive figure in public life today.
Yeah. And is that an extension of the filmmaker, or do you think that the film is done fairly and does that still occur? I'd love to see it. I haven't seen it yet.
In the end, there are two factors there. There's Julian Assange as a person, and there is WikiLeaks as a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And the two have been linked together, but maybe you have to separate the two.
Well, it's tough because we live in a gray world. But if you take WikiLeaks and you say, okay, let's make it black and white. On balance, is it better for society to have this kind of a freedom of information that may even intercept people's lives? Or on balance, is it better to keep this kind of closed down? I mean, that's a core problem, you know.
You'll be in conversation with Clone Crosley at the Bryant Park Outdoor Reading Room on Wednesday, August 7th at 12:30 p.m., I understand. More information on our show page. That's Sloan, right?
Yes.
they wrote it CL and then corrected themselves. There's more information about that on our show page at WNYC.org. Are you going to go back to writing novels, or is nonfiction the way for the time being?
You know, I enjoy doing both. I feel like that in general, the perception of my nonfiction is that it's better than my fiction. I enjoy doing fiction more. It is more difficult. I guess I'm not really – I haven't thought that far ahead. I don't really think more than one project ahead.
And meanwhile, you have every Sunday you're committed to writing another article on ethics.
Yes.
That has to be difficult. Did the letters that come in, are they all meaty enough to keep you going?
Well, you know, you get a lot of questions there. Many of them are not about ethics at all. They're either about sort of etiquette, or they're just someone sort of saying something very crazy and bombastic about the way they view the world. Of the questions that are about ethics, you got to find one that fits in the space. And most importantly, you have to find one that's bigger than just the question. It has to apply to other people.
Chuck Klosterman is the New York Times bestselling author of a number of books. The new one we've been discussing is I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. It's published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.